We welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one, we'll be talking about Kenosha's beautiful manor house and a Kenosha Symphony fundraiser coming up this weekend. Part two features a conversation about the grand opening of the gallery on 16th Street in Racine. Stay with us. Well, it's always exciting when we can connect with anyone involved with the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra, which is such a gem in our community. And under the direction now, not only of conductor Dr. Robert Hasty, but a new executive director by the name of Ken Murray. And we're going to be meeting him and also talking to two people who care passionately about the symphony and are, in a sense, hosting what promises to be a spectacular fundraiser for the orchestra this weekend, hosting it at the Manor House, which they own. Roberta Puntillo, Roberta Jorgensen Puntillo, and Kurt Jorgensen, who own the Manor House and are making it available to the symphony. And it is a rare treat to be able to step into the front door of this beautiful, beautiful mansion. And of course, the cause is a great one in supporting the Kenosha Symphony and their ongoing presence in our community. So we're going to be talking about the Manor House, its history, and what it's like to own something like that, and what is going to be happening at this exciting fundraiser this weekend. So Ken Murray, the executive director of the Kenosha Symphony, Roberta Jorgensen Puntillo, Kurt Jorgensen, we welcome all three of you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Yes, thank you, Greg, for having us.
Good to have you here. Ken, you are pretty much brand new on the job as executive director.
I am.
Tell us how you find yourself in this position and how it's been so far.
Well, I moved to Kenosha just 3 years ago in April and have made Kenosha my home, really enjoy the community quite a bit. And through a series of circumstances, I'd found myself in town but working in Illinois. And with a background in both project management and nonprofit management, had been connected with the Kenosha Symphony through some community members I'm sure you're familiar with, Bob Schneider with the Community Foundation, some other volunteers among that cadre. And I really think that through a series of just conversations that started, myself and Roberta, who serves on the board of directors, as well as Kenneth Lenz, who was the board president at the time, and it seemed like a great fit for me, and I think that the board felt similarly about my fit with the symphony and was excited to take on this task of really caretaking or taking care of the symphony as an institution. It's been in this town for now 77 years, and it's a privilege to get to work with the organization and ensure that it can be around for another 77.
Very good. Do you come at this as a musician yourself, or is that not particularly part of your background?
Well, it's not particularly a part of my profession any longer. I do have a background in music. As a child, was educated with music kind of as a forefront. Played the trumpet myself through college, actually.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I never pursued performance or even music education as a career path, but certainly something that's near and dear to my heart.
Right. Well, then, this is a great position for you, and, of course, you're part of a venerable organization that this community really loves and has supported in some exciting ways. So has it been a wild ride thus far? Well, I suspect it has been.
Yeah, it's maybe a bit more glamorous than simply the title of nonprofit manager might might belie. Yeah, there's a lot going on. There's a lot that's been done in the last 77 years, and really I already know to be a deep love, as you mentioned, within the community for the organization. So what's been really exciting has been the establishment of relationships for myself with members of the community who feel very strongly about ensuring that the symphony is around for years to come. And and yes, you know, the history has a real great the symphony has a real great history that hasn't always included a full-time director or manager. So just like any business venture, there's a lot of tasks that need tending, And so it's been exciting to try to work with the board to develop processes that will help sustain the organization and move it forward.
Very good. We will take time with probably Conductor Hasty at some point in terms of talking about specific concerts.
Certainly.
But maybe you can just kind of sketch out the basics of the upcoming season.
Yes, the upcoming season begins October 15th, with our first performance. And there will be four public performances this year. The following performances will fall on December 10th, February 25th, and April 29th, all four of those being Saturday performances. This year, like in years past, our performances will be held at Reuther Central High School in the Reuther Auditorium. And there's some very great information already on our website at www.kenoshasymphony.org. But the season itself will be a great diverse program, beginning with a German program or an Oktoberfest on October 15th. And then moving into an annual holiday concert that we host with the help of Snap-on Incorporated. In February, we'll be seeing a program called Noche de Pasión. A Latin Grammy-nominated guitarist is going to be joining us from Southern California. His name is David Maldonado. And as I understand through conversations with Bob Hasty, who's been working very closely with this artist, he's developing his book or essentially orchestrating his music for our symphony. And then finally in April, our final concert of the year will include some music by Russian composers, both Tchaikovsky and Shostakovich. So really quite an exciting year. And one of growth over last year, which we're excited about.
Absolutely. It's always great to see an organization moving forward in exciting ways. So for those of you just joining us, we've been speaking just now with Ken Murray, who is the brand new executive director of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra, talking about their season, which opens on Saturday, the 15th of October. And we also have with us in the studios two people who very much appreciate and support the symphony all kinds of different ways, Roberta Jorgensen-Pontillo and Kurt Jorgensen, and they happen to own the Manor House. And if any of you have ever been inside the Manor House, you know that it is a beautiful, beautiful mansion and an exciting and beautiful place in which to host something like the upcoming fundraiser, which is coming up this very weekend, Sunday the 18th, between 4 and 8 o'clock. So first of all, let's talk a little bit about how the two of you came into possession of the Manor House. I understand it was one half of your partnership who was really excited about that and kind of pushed for this to happen.
Yes, that one half of the partnership was my husband, Kurt. I was actually very apprehensive about moving into a home. It was definitely a mansion to me, and nothing I ever expected to live in during my lifetime. Mm. So I grew up very humbly, and I was actually concerned that our family would even fit in a place like the Manor House. I can say that it has been a wonderful experience, and it is truly our home now. It's not the ostentatious palace that I was concerned about. We have four children, and so when you come in, you know, there's toys, there's laundry, there's all the stuff that you would expect in a home.
Real life is there.
Real life is going on. But what I do love is that there are so many times that I just look at a room or look at some portion of the house that I truly just sit back and I appreciate, I admire the craftsmanship that went into building this place. I love the history because my husband, too, he wasn't brought up in a home like this either. And and so for him, it was all about the history. He felt very strongly that somebody who cared about the history of Kenosha and wanted to preserve such a beautiful place would own it. Hmm. And he has really spearheaded all of the projects behind what has gone on in the few years we have been there. He's renovated a lot of bathrooms. He has, redone the basement. He has redone the second floor recently. A lot that I don't have the energy for, unfortunately.
Yeah,
he has, but he is a history, he's a history buff and loves being there.
So this has been something of a fixer-upper, albeit not the typical fixer-upper that we think of.
Well, I don't want to give that impression.
Yeah, we certainly don't want to portray that it was a fixer-upper.
No.
The people that had owned it prior, Dr. Peterson, took wonderful care of the home for 15-plus years, and Stacy Breeden had owned it for 15 years prior to us owning it, and she certainly put a lot of time and energy into restoration and preservation of the property. It just, it's a living organism, and it needs constant updating and, and patience. Well, and
right, and of course, for it to be a workable home for you and your children, things had to happen. So yes, that was a poor joke on my part to call it a fixer-upper. It's much more than that. How did you become aware of it being even available? And how long a process are we talking about in terms of sort of wrestling with this intriguing possibility?
Well, we had actually lived in a new home in Pleasant Prairie for several years, and I had been looking for a historic property in Kenosha downtown for 5, 6, 7 years, and none of them quite fit our lifestyle. And one of the things for me is I need car space, garage space. I enjoy cars. I enjoy old cars. And that house has the ability to park more cars than any other house down Third Avenue, because there's a back garage. Little did I realize once we bought the home that the four-car garage attached to the house is designed for 1926 Nashes.
Oh, dear.
So we made our way around that. But a friend of ours knew the former owner, and it was time for her to shift gears and transition into a smaller home. Most of her family had moved out and whatnot, and it was timing. It was timing. So we were able to put together a transition for us to buy the home between her and her father, and it worked out very well. So it was all timing.
What was your draw to that Third Avenue historic district? I mean, I suppose somebody might conceivably be drawn to live in that neighborhood for its proximity to certain things of interest, but I suspect, given what your wife was saying about you, that this had nothing to do with geographical location as much as sort of the meaning behind the neighborhood.
I actually think it was both for him, just to to probably answer that, because we lived in Pleasant Prairie, and we loved our home and our neighbors, but it was a little bit more remote than I think, you know, I grew up here, so I feel connected to the community. I've been here all my life. But for my husband, I think it was important for him to feel like he could, you know, walk outside and see neighbors very easily, walk to a park and see more people, walk downtown and have dinner. It's really been a great location along with a great home. So I do feel like the location has played into our decision.
Very good. So when was the Manor House built, and what can you tell us about sort of the long stretch of its history?
The Manor House was actually built in 1926. And interestingly, so the architects were Pond and Pond, and Charles Nash gifted the home to his daughter, who had married James Wilson. So it was known as the Wilson home for many years. And so that's the original owner of the home. And you'll see the Wilson crest actually throughout the home. So he was the original owner, the James Wilson family. And in, what was it, Kurt, the 1960s about? I believe that it was donated to Kemper. Because, yeah, go ahead.
So the transition, the family owned it for many years, and near the tail end of their ownership, they didn't live in the home. The handyman lived in the home, and it was somewhat in disrepair. And the removed family that owned it had a decision to make. They were either going to tear the house down or donate it to the sisters at Kemper Hall. And the cost of the teardown was $80,000. So they opted to donate it to the school, the nuns, and it was used for many years to house the headmaster and also to perform some classes and functions and things there.
Yeah.
And then Dr. Peterson.
Yeah, Dr. Peterson actually purchased the property then, and he put a lot of time and effort and money into, he's the person who created
the
Manor House. Yes,
savior.
He saved that property, and he is responsible for its name, the Manor House. He ran it as a bed and breakfast, although he did not personally live there. And then from the bed and breakfast, which gave it its name, it was purchased by a private, private party, and that was Stacy Breeden, the former owner, who also took very good care of the home. I mean, she put beautiful. She restored the slate roof just prior to our purchase, and it's just just beautiful, the things she did. She updated the kitchen. She had done a lot. Mm. So I know that she took very good care of the home. That's as well.
Right. One of my fondest memories of the place is that for quite a few years, it was the site of the Carthage Christmas party, the party for the whole faculty and staff, and it was usually my chamber singers who would actually offer the entertainment, which is so I really had to be there year after year, but wanted to be there year after year, and it was such a beautiful place for that kind of an event. And lots of other events, of course, have been held there, and it's absolutely ideal for those kind of special occasions that you want to occur in a really special place. Tell our listeners maybe a couple of intriguing features about the home that might not be immediately obvious. I mean, just beyond its beauty, which is, of course, very apparent.
Well, some of the architectural interest points are in the basement. There was a squash court in a billiards room. Jim Weary was a sportsman big into gamesmanship and an outdoorsman also. Up in the attic, there is a ballroom with a leather floor. So they used to have famous bands and orchestras come up from Chicago during the day and play for a lot of the leading families in town. And, you know, also there's 10 fireplaces.
Mm-hmm. 10 fireplaces.
Yes. We use that to somewhat manage the heat. It's a steam boiler system in the house. So it's definitely an art form to keep the house heated properly and zoned and whatnot. There was 14 bathrooms at one time. There's 11 now. I decommissioned 3 of them. So it certainly is a commercial-type property.
Wow.
Yes. Kurt mentioned Jim Weary. We've had some really interesting meetings with people who have a connection to the home, and one was with the great-grandson of Charles Nash. That was the Jim Weary that Kurt mentioned. He lectures throughout the country on his history with Nash, and he came to our Christmas party last year and had some wonderful stories of growing up in that home and his parents being married there. And
how splendid.
Yes. His parents were married in front of the fireplace in 1937. Jim lived there as a baby in the home, so he had wonderful stories. And
of course, what we sometimes hear are what really kind of amount to horror stories about gorgeous, wonderful, venerable homes that somebody moves into and either allows them to kind of go to pot, or who come in and don't seem to have proper appreciation for its historic value and historic kind of beauty, and sort of tear out all the woodwork and do this and do that. And that's probably one of the things we should be really grateful for, is it sounds like, for the most part, everybody who has owned this home has cherished its sense of history and its own kind of unique character, and nothing's been done to alter any of that.
Absolutely, and we definitely feel a sense of duty to preserve that home as it was and should be into the future. So we have a very strong sense of duty in that regard, and not change. We're not going to.
We're simply caretakers of the home. That's the way we look at it.
Wow.
And Dr. Peterson placed the home on the National Historic Register list in 1980, so we feel responsible to the community and also that. You know, that group also.
Wow. Now, does that in any sense constrain what you would do with the home? I mean, in any kind of official way?
It's
that designation?
It's really pertains to the exterior of the home.
Ah.
So it's really, we cannot modify the exterior of the home per se, but any of the remodeling we've done inside, we've done in a period type fashion.
Okay.
So.
And what does it feel like for your children to live there? It feels like home to you, and does it feel like home to them as well?
Oh, I think definitely. Considering our foyer has been used as pretty much a racetrack for the little ones to drive their little whether it be their little toy cars, or generally not the scooters, but they don't. I mean, I think they recognize that it's large, but it's definitely a whole big playland for them. It's not a museum.
With four children and friends, the house is always lively, and it's full of a lot of people. So,
yes, which is just what we wanted, actually. Yeah. We wanted to have it be a very welcoming place, despite what it may look like on the outside.
Despite its grandeur.
Right, it is. Yeah. It is. It's very grand and beautiful and something to be appreciated, but also a place to enjoy.
Well, I know you want lots of people tromping into your house
this
Sunday evening for this very special fundraiser. Tell us what's been put together. What's going to happen?
Well, I think what's really exciting about this is the opportunity that now the general public through this event with the Kenosha Symphony will have to see the home and see it not only for the historic thing that it is, but also to see it as the home of Roberta and Kurt and their family, and at least for this Sunday, the home of the symphony. We're excited to present a few things that we think appeal to a large swath of the population. One of those items being music. There will be some chamber music performed by members of the Kenosha Symphony. Unfortunately, we weren't able to coordinate a full symphony concert at the home.
Cozy.
Yes, yeah. All jokes aside, but there will be some great music provided by our musicians. And as well as, or in addition to that, we're really excited to have a Kenosha native in Mary Radigan, who is currently the executive chef at Zazzybee restaurant in downtown Kenosha. She and the staff there at Zazzybee have agreed to help us put on this event from a food and beverage standpoint. We're really looking forward to an event that brings forth the finest that the culinary culture of Kenosha has to offer, and really looking forward to a time where people can come and eat and drink and enjoy company with one another and help us to both raise awareness about the symphony's programs, but also to raise funds for the symphony to help us through not only this year, but well into the future.
Great. So is this an event where people drop in and out as they see fit?
Yes, it is a ticketed event. So in that way, it's not an open house per se, but with the purchase of a ticket, an individual will be able to come and go as they please. The ticket purchase does include all of the food that's going to be prepared by Mary and her crew. It's not a formal dinner per se, but something where there will be small plates prepared throughout the evening that people can grab and enjoy at various tables outside in the garden or inside in the home. And there's also going to be a silent auction that will run throughout the evening. So that's going to start at 4:00, but will run probably past 7:00. And then a live auction and a small presentation to close our evening. And that'll begin around 7:00 and probably wrap up around 7:30. So, we would encourage people to come as they're able. We know that there are lots of great events going on in the community this time of year, especially as the last of the summer weather is here for us to enjoy. But we would encourage anyone, to come and join us at Kurt and Roberta's home at the Manor House anytime after 4:00.
And if people are interested in purchasing a ticket, what's the best thing for them to do?
Well, the easiest way for most of your listeners will be to go to our website. Again, that's KenoshaSymphony.org, and tickets are for sale there. But they could also purchase a ticket by calling our office or by stopping in at Zazzybee restaurant in downtown Kenosha. They're also selling tickets on our behalf. So
very good. The phone number there, 262-220-7526. 262-220-7526. Otherwise, www.kenoshasymphony.org. Ken Murray is the new executive director of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. Congratulations. It's great to meet you.
And thank you, sir.
We wish you well with all the good work we know you will do for this fine organization. And Kurt Jorgensen and Roberta Jorgensen-Pontillo, wonderful to have you here to hear about your relationship with this beautiful home and your generosity in making it available to the Kenosha Symphony for this special occasion. Very best wishes to you and many years of happiness in that beautiful, beautiful manor house.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks, Greg.
I'm Greg Reberg. And it is exciting to spend this portion of WGTD's morning show talking about one of the loveliest little gems on the Racine artistic landscape, a space known as, it's collectively sort of known as the 16th Street Studios Gallery. It's a building where all kinds of different artists, in a sense, make their artistic home. And this Thursday, the 15th of September, is the grand opening of what is amounts to sort of a new space that augments the gallery on 16th. And it's going to be a very, very splendid space for the showing of artwork and a place for artists and those who love art to gather and, in a sense, celebrate together. And so this grand opening is coming up on Thursday from 6 until 9 p.m. And we have with us today on the morning show, first of all, Samira Gadisis, who is director of Gallery on 16th. She's also owner of the Black Eyed Press, which is one of the tenants of this venerable historic building. And the building is owned by the family of Emily Wrench Montgomery. So she helps manage the building, and she serves on the steering committee for the Gallery on 16th with Samira Gadisis. And so they are here to talk about what this space is intended to be and the exciting plans that they have for it and what's going to be happening at the grand opening celebration, which, again, is this Thursday, 6 to 9. Samira Gadisis, Emily Wrench Montgomery, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you.
For the sake of listeners who don't know what building we're talking about, let's begin with that geographical basic. Exactly where is this building? And describe a little bit about it and its history.
Well, we're on 16th Street between Junction and Memorial Drive, just a little bit west of S.C. Johnson. It is rather historical. It was built, the first part of the building was built in the 1860s, and then in the 1870s, Racine Wagon and Carriage Company moved in, and they started expanding the building and kept adding on until about 1905. Obviously, with the advent of automobiles, the wagon business took a nosedive. And though they did not embrace the manufacturing of automobiles, they did open up their building to other manufacturing businesses and became the first business incubator in the country. Mm. So by, and that happened in 1914. By 1916, they changed the name of the building to Racine Industrial Plant to better reflect what was going on. And then in 1990, my family changed it to Racine Business Center to then again better reflect what was going on in the building. Mm. My grandfather bought it in 1944. He was an entrepreneur in the building, and he and Fred von Trotter bought it in 1944, but our family, the Wrenches, have owned it since then.
Wow. I had forgotten about that earliest portion of its history, that idea of it being an incubator.
Yes.
And of course, that's a really hot term right now. And it's one of the most sort of exciting concepts of innovation that we see. And it's so wonderful to think about the city of Racine, the invention city, the city of invention being a place where that happened, maybe for the very first time.
Well, some of our Modine, big name in Racine, they incubated with us. We had Weary Trunk. We've had D.W. Davies, Scan-O-Matic. I suppose if you're from Racine, you know these businesses. What's really exciting is how the demographic is morphing into a very strong artistic community. We're getting a lot of creatives. We're up to 60 artists now in the building, which they have now surpassed the entrepreneurs. But it's a good mixture of both. And in the very heart of the building is Shea Bob's Cafe. And he literally is the heart and soul of the building. And the entrepreneurs and the artists, the general public come, and they're able to mix and meet. And I know for a fact that the artists have approached some of the entrepreneurs to have welding done, or we have a picture framer, which is really appropriate for having a large community of artists in there. So there's they cohabitate this building and really share their talents.
Mm. So at what point did this become something of a mecca of local artists? And did that happen sort of accidentally? I mean, did one day you wake up and, my word, there's all these artists that are suddenly interested in moving in? Or was there kind of a concerted effort to kind of shift into that direction?
Well, that's a good question that I can't actually answer, because my husband Arthur, who's the facilities manager, and I moved away for 16 years and came back, and the community had already been established when we were gone. Now, back in the 1980s, my sister had a art studio in there. I had another friend who had a design studio in there. But they didn't stay around. In the 90s is when more of the artists were moving in, because we've got these big windows and the brick and beam and the lighting is great and it's that warehouse feel. And one of the benefits of the kind of wide open spaces that we have is that we can throw up walls where necessary, take walls down. So in the contraction, expansion of business and economy, we can accommodate that.
Mm.
And so the artists discovered that while we were gone. But when we moved back, we started deliberately developing new space with art studios in mind, because that's who's been really seeking us out, and that's where our substantial growth has been.
Samira Gadisis, you are a tenant, the owner of Black Eyed Press. When did you move into the building?
At the beginning of October, it'll be 4 years, which seems crazy. we were originally with a big gallery of our own on 6th Street and had a situation where we needed to find another space, and originally had looked at the building when I walked into my studio, which is it's a pretty large space, one of the largest studios with big windows and freight elevators and loading docks, because I have a lot of heavy equipment. I knew immediately that it was the space, and we're super happy there. We hold classes and have people stop in all the time and try to be there when we know the general public's there, so they can learn about what we do and learn about printmaking and book arts, and then know that, you know, I'm not the only artist there, so then I'm able to talk about, you know, my many colleagues, which it's an amazing community. Some people think of artists being these solitary,
right,
angry people, but in our community, it's not that way. And when you need something, there's always someone there. And Emily talked about, you know, having help from the entrepreneurs. The last big press I moved in is a 102-year-old letter press. And when it came in, the man who delivered it crooked. And, I mean, very crooked. And so I went down to Shea Bob's and said, Bob, do you know anyone with a forklift? And in 5 minutes, we had one of the entrepreneurs with a forklift in my space moving my press. And it's not just like that. There are engineers that will help us install. And, you know, it's not just the picture framer. It's people who are going outside of their own special, you know, entrepreneurial way to help us to do what we do best. And so it becomes this great relationship and community amongst the artist, and then, you know, more organically within, you know, the business community. So it's a really lovely place to be.
So talk even more specifically about that moment when you say you walked in and thought to yourself, this is it. this is my space. This is where I need to be. What exactly about that space was so right for you and for your particular artistic needs?
Well, like many artists, I started creating in my basement years ago in a 5x5 foot square space, you know, and then, you know, pretty soon it was outside at the Anderson Art Center. I had a 10x10 space while I was going back to art school. Art is my, you know, second bachelor's and probably my first love, but I didn't realize that right away. And then when we moved into 6th Street, we had a lot of beautiful gallery and classroom, but we had very little actual workspace. So you spend a lot of time promoting other artists and very little creative time of your own in that sort of space. When I walked in to this beautiful, it's about 1,200 square feet of northern light, three huge, you know, windows, high ceilings, floors I don't have to worry about. it was, you know, sometimes you find a place where you know the space is like home. And for me, it really is my second home. It's larger than our home. You just know. But I also knew so many of the artists had become mentors to me and helped me to critique work and helped me to hang work in the other space. Artists like Maggie Venn and Maureen Fritchin and, you know, several of the other artists in the building I knew throughout the community. So it was just comfortable from the moment you walked in, and you knew you could be creative in the space because you were starting out with something you were going to make your own.
Wow. Emily, I'm curious, when you say that you, in a sense, tried to reshape the building a bit and create some spaces that would be so inviting for somebody like Samira, what kinds of things did you do to the building to make it more attractive for potential artists?
Well, we try to match what they're doing with the area that we place them. With artwork, you're going to have some smelly things, some noisy things. So we want to make sure that we're not putting a wood shop next to an oil painter. It was trial and error, though. So we are learning as we go along with this. We've gotten better about that. And when a fairly large business moved out, they moved to Illinois, they were tucked in a space that has been designated art studio space. So it was a no-brainer to develop that into more studios. And when Arthur and I were mapping it out, we also wanted to try to have multiple price points available. So we have some really small places that are going to be more affordable to the artist on a budget. Well, of course, what artist isn't on a budget? But there are a lot of people who want to be in the building, but they don't necessarily need a 1,200 square foot space or an 800. So we have some small 200 ones. And so we were really deliberate on creating different sizes. And that was when I told Arthur that when we developed that space, I want a space for a gallery for the artists, because we have a historical exhibit in the building as well. So I do a lot of tours, and as part of my dog and pony show, I tell our guests about our large artist community, and inevitably their interest is piqued. They want to go see the studios, they want to go see the artists, but during the day we might not have a lot of artists. So with a gallery, I can take our visitors to see the kind of artwork that these artists are doing. So I was really excited that Arthur let me designate a space. The problem with that, though, was it wasn't really accessible to the general public, who might be there coming for on Thursdays for Bob's Meatloaf Madness that he's famous for. And so the move to the second floor was really an important move. But anyway, going back to your original question, of that's just how we kind of develop the space, is making sure that we're trying to match the artists and what their endeavors are with the area that we're developing.
Right. So in other words, people have all kinds of other reasons to come to the building, including those who visit this historical exhibit that kind of talks about the history of the building and what has gone on there. And when you mention that we have lots of artists in this building, but they look around and see no evidence of it, and it's not like it's a music conservatory where you hear the
right.
the sound of singing at a distance. I mean, you wanted in a way to be able to demonstrate that, yes, we have artists here, and they create wonderful artwork of one kind or another, and this gallery is a place they can go and see the work that is created there. Now, tell us about the original gallery. What did it look like? And is this new space larger?
Yes, the new space is quite a bit larger. It's on the second floor, which is easily accessible by the passenger elevator, so that makes it easier, handicap accessible as well. Whereas on the third floor, though it was a nice space, it had northern light, it was tucked in with the artists, which was pretty cool to if there was somebody there, I would, you know, tap on their door and be able to, people would be able to see their studios. But it just really wasn't conducive to the general public being, you know, being able to have it be accessible. So I think the original one was about 600 square feet. Not all of our artists, we're up to 60 artists now, not all of them have been showing in the gallery, but a fair amount of them have. We have sculptors and painters and metal workers, and so we need a fair amount of space to have a good representation. And the second floor location really lends itself. I don't remember how many square feet it is, but I think it's 900.
Close to 900.
Yeah, so wow. we added quite a bit more. And we just installed some French doors, so when people walk through, if it's closed, we're open on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but if it's closed, they can at least get a good peek walking by. And the second floor is one of the main thoroughfare floors from one side of the building to the next. We have two entrances, the 1515 entrance and the 1405 entrance, and many 1515 Street. When people use that entrance, they're going to walk right by the gallery, the new gallery, on their way to Shea Bob's. So
it's a great place to be, and more noticeable for one thing, and more easily accessible. And
right,
sounds like an exciting change.
Well, the other demographic that we've seen growing in the building are the merchandisers, and these are people who have maybe Etsy or eBay sites selling vintage items, but they want a brick and mortar shop. They don't necessarily want to have retail type hours, so they are open also limited hours during the week, because we're not set up for retail, but they can have a shop. And there we are locating them on the second floor as well. We are deliberately trying to grow that area to specifically have the merchandisers. And so it just lends itself to kind of piggyback on the public that's coming in for that as well.
Excellent. Samira, tell us what's going to happen at this grand opening celebration on Thursday.
Well, we decided originally we wanted to have just an event. We had kind of a soft opening a couple months ago just to get our artists warmed up to the space. And we do have really good usage of the gallery. I think we have 25 artists showing opening this Thursday. We have we will have refreshments. We'll have, you know, some drinks, some food, and the artists who are showing will be present, so they'll be able to represent their work. The exciting piece of this gallery is that it allows us to step out and also work in the community and introduce young artists and those who are interested in arts management to the work itself and the artists in the building. So for this show, we had an intern from Carthage brought in. His name is Colton Keener, and he spent the summer with us doing the hard work. I mean, he cleaned floors and patched walls and painted long before he hung that first show. But the most important work he did was talk and meet all the artists and get to know their work. So part of the reward for a young artist who thinks maybe the curation side or, you know, the gallery side is for them is the opportunity to curate a show, which for me as an intern under Emil Mathis, who was a great supporter of the arts when he was alive in Racine, was an important part of what I enjoy doing. And so Colton came in and chose a theme and presented it to the artists, and 25, 26 of us showed up and said, sure, we can support that. And he was able to walk into our studios and point out pieces he liked. So either pieces are developed in that theme or, you know, he chose pieces that were already done or asked artists to do that. So he's a minimalist. He describes himself as a minimalist artist. He's a wonderful photographer and young artist. But he chose the theme neutral, which was much harder than any of us expected.
Yeah.
Not for all of us. For some of our abstract artists, this was like a breath of fresh air. From some of us that are more concrete and really love wild and crazy colors, a little more difficult.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you can see that some of the artists have tried to challenge him and brought pieces in that thematically or conceptually are neutral, but maybe are a little more difficult visually to put in. But all of the work is really good, solid work that has its own story to tell.
Huh.
So Colton will be with us on Thursday, even though he's started classes already.
Right.
You know, he's basically almost finished his internship. This will be the culmination of his internship with us. And he'll come in and talk about what he decided to do and what he did there. And we're just, we had a really good time with him. At one point, he was reading a book, and I, as his supervisor, walked in and said, "So what are you reading?" And he said, "Da da 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 da," and I said, "Okay, well, one second." And I ran next door and got some books on museum studies and curation and the visitor's idea of the museum and brought them in. And then he actually read through two pretty serious master's level books while he was with us. He's a really motivated young student. Super exciting for us.
Sounds like a marriage made in or match made in heaven. He was exactly the right person for you, and you were the right people for him. And What a joy that must be.
It really, really, truly was a joy.
So this will celebrate that as well. Emily, real quick, we just have a minute or two left. You are the managers of the building. What challenges are involved in managing, first of all, an older space and a complex space in terms of so many different tenants doing so many different things? It's not like you have 60 different accountants in this building.
And you said we only had a little short time.
Yeah, right.
With over 100 tenants.
Yeah.
That's a lot of personalities.
Right.
In a very old building with, I wish I knew how many windows we had. It's a very large challenge. One of the things that I discovered in curating the exhibit, reading through an old article that my grandfather was interviewed in, it was important to him when he bought the building to ensure that there was affordable space for entrepreneurs in order to pursue their dreams and endeavors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're doing a pretty good job of keeping that going. It's not easy heating a building of that size. I think 1 month it was like $80,000. Yeah. And of course, we get complaints in the summer that it's too hot. We get complaints in the winter that it's too cold, or it's too hot because, you know, the heat's pushing through. And and trying to replace windows. We try to keep the integrity of the historical aspect of the building. I think we've done a pretty good job with that, too. Technically, it's my husband who's the manager. I assist him.
Well, I'm sure he's grateful for every ounce of assistance you can give him. Well, it's such an exciting addition to the community, and it's wonderful that it's there. And when one looks at the list of artists who are there, it's a really imposing list. And, of course, there is the regular hours that people can come in, and it'll now be Tuesdays and Thursdays. People can come in 10 to 3 and kind of see some of these artists at work. And then this grand celebration. Now, do people need tickets or anything for this event Thursday night?
Nope, it's completely free. Everyone's our guests. I do want to say I'm so impressed with the depth and breadth of talent of the creative community in this building. It's really something to see, and I say please come check it out.
The grand opening celebration of the new gallery on 16th is this Thursday, 6 to 9. Emily Wrench Montgomery, Samira Gadisis, great to have both of you here. Thank you so much, and thank you for all that you're doing for the city of Racine.
Thank you.
I'm Gregory Berg. And the guests wanted to be sure to add that the gallery on 16th is funded in this first year by an Art Seed grant. My thanks to both of them for joining me for part two of today's morning show. Tomorrow on the morning show, Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, joins me for his monthly visit to the program, offering analysis of all kinds of current events and issues of concern. On Thursday, it will be an exciting morning show indeed, as we have live in our studios six renowned cartoonists from across the country, all in town for this year's Kenosha Festival of Cartooning. We'll have with us, among others, John Hambrock from Kenosha, who's responsible for the wonderful comic strip, The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee. And we will have other cartoonists as well, including an animator for the series Phineas and Ferb, and also the cartoonist responsible for the outstanding comic strip Non Sequitur, all joining us live.